And then, you know, I was about to give up, and Abigail said, you know, what about university presses? She goes, they are the new independent presses.
Hi, welcome to Writing Stories, your spot for conversations with contemporary authors about how books go from an idea in someone's head to an object on a shelf. I'm Brianna Avinya Tapper, and my guest today is Stephanie Claire Smith.
Hey there.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm pretty good.
Stephanie Claire Smith's first book, Everywhere the Undrowned, a memoir of survival and imagination, was described as stunningly lyrical and profoundly insightful and masterful by Kirkus. The Washington Post called it a work of literature. I found it truly transformative. By the last page, I felt stronger and more whole than I did when I began, and that feeling has stayed with me. In the weeks since, I have returned again and again to this book. But despite, or really because of its accolades and beauty, the story of its journey to publication is particularly fascinating to me, at least, and also encouraging. It's a great case study in why you shouldn't assume a connection between your worth, skill, or talent as a writer and the ease or difficulty with which you publish your work. In other words, Everywhere the Undrowned is writing that many people think is spectacular and that took a long time to become a book. Everywhere the Undrowned is about the summer when Stephanie was 14 and her mother left her in their New Orleans apartment by herself when she went for a six-week-ish camping trip with her boyfriend. While her mother was gone, 14-year-old Stephanie was raped by a stranger at knife point. Everywhere the Undrowned is about how she lived through that experience as a child and the ways that it then rippled out through the rest of her life. It is about how we survive as children and how we go back and save ourselves as adults. I don't normally read passages on this podcast, but I was so taken with Stephanie's voice, and it's so distinctive that I think you have to hear some lines in order to get a good sense of the book, so I'm going to read a short passage. I remember asking my mother not to go on her trip. We stood in the living room on the green shag rug. Her favorite abstract painting hung on the wall over her shoulder, a pale blue still life with unconventional lemons spilled across a square table. In our mini aquarium, the pair of small African frogs came up for air and floated on the surface among all the bubbles while I readied myself to just ask her to stay or else take me along with her. Asking was like attempting a U-turn on the high dive ladder at the community pool. Everyone cringes as you climb down the ladder. You think you want solid ground under your feet, but it's better to just get it over with and jump in the damn water. The sting of hitting the water is just a fast slap in the face. And shame looks better underwater anyway. You'll be fine, she rolled her eyes. Teenagers love being on their own, you'll see. Then she smiled. You won't even want me to come back. I stared at her suitcase and nodded.
After my mother died, it kind of cleared up space for me to see the connection between her, what I didn't even want to term neglect. I didn't like that term, but her parenting. And what happened to me, I was able to start to see it for the first time. I think, you know, what I had done, because my mother had many wonderful qualities, is I was able to kind of project this perfect picture onto her, not perfect, but a good enough picture that stuck. And it, because there were no other allies, I had really nobody else, and we moved a lot. So I didn't have any other person. She was the best there was. And so I created this image of her. And then after she died, I don't think I could afford to start taking it apart until after she died, that it still was serving me.
Right.
And when she died, and I could now start to, there were always some pieces that I couldn't make sense of, like, how could she be this and this thing and this thing? Mm-hmm. But mostly I just blamed myself. Mm-hmm. And so what was really hard in the writing, well, in the therapy, but then also in the writing, was I was now dismantling the view I created. I created it. I was the beneficiary of it. And now I was dismantling it.
I think it's incredibly relatable. You know, all parents are different, but I think that core idea of the fantasy parent that we create because we need to as children, and then how we go about dismantling it is a very relatable process.
Do you remember the first time that you thought of yourself as someone who could write a book?
Once it was published. I mean, I never even thought of writing as a profession or something. I didn't know anybody who made a living. I still don't know anybody who makes a living off of it. It just didn't seem like a job choice. So I didn't really think of that. I always loved writing. Even as a kid, I wrote poems. And so I always saw myself with words. And I think Virginia Woolf said, nothing is whole for her until it's in words. So it was kind of that. I was digging through all this material of my own life. And then I read Maggie Nelson's Bluettes and loved it. I loved it. I just was inhaling it. So I would go to sleep at night and my poems would start to smush out into paragraphs, or the poems had more to say. I had to get up and write it down, you know. I would have no intention of writing a book. And I got about 13 pages of these, my own paragraphs, and showed it to a poet friend who said, you know, I don't really know what this is, but just keep going. And then it just was something I couldn't stop doing, you know, in my lunch break or after work. So when I had about 50 pages, I showed it to a writer friend of mine who's published, and she was very enthusiastic about it. And she's not that enthusiastic about many things. So I took that to heart. And that's when I started to think, oh, maybe this could be a book.
So when you got 50 pages in and you thought, okay, it could be a book. So where did you go from there? Did you outline? Did you have a specific goal? What was your plan?
Well, she had suggested, rightly so, that I now start writing about caregiving for my mother and more, move it more into the present. And because I don't think I had much of the present yet. I don't think I did. I think I had stopped. So I just went, I can't do outlines very well. So I kind of write in spirals and hodgepodge, obviously. So that's what I did. And then when I got to a place where I felt like I could show it to somebody else, I showed it to this other writer, Abigail DeWitt, who's published. I didn't know her at the time. So it was really nerve wracking for me to ask people, hey, would you read this? And she did. I'm always grateful to these people who read these. And she also loved it, which I couldn't believe this. You know, I just couldn't believe that people were really liking this. And so then I was trying to get it ready to send out to an agent. And yeah, that was hard.
I want to ask about that. But first, how did you choose Abigail DeWitt, and why did you send it to her specifically? How'd that work?
So I go to this writer's conference in the summer called Table Rock Writing Workshop that Georgianne Eubanks and Donna Campbell have organized. And Abigail is the teacher there. So then Abigail, I don't know why I picked her. I just kind of was like, well, I'm just going to ask her. I needed to ask somebody. And she'd been really nice and just passing at the conference. I hadn't even taken a class with her. But I just thought, I need somebody to take a look at it. And I don't know that many people. I didn't want feedback too early. So, I mean, I got it from Georgianne about, you know, write some more. And then I wrote some more and then felt like, now I need to hear what I need to change. How can I get this ready? Is it really going to reach somebody? And when Abigail, you know, really loved all of it, just pumped me up with confidence to take the next step, you know, that she felt that it was ready, just had good things to say about all of it, that it had little hearts over all of it.
No, that's awesome.
Yeah, I was bowled over because I was really ready to hear some, you know, tough love. And I mean, she might have one comment later when I was struggling to get an agent, where she said, you know, we need to see more your mom's boyfriend. Like, what did he look like? So I put, what did the apartment look like? You know, where was it? So I added those things in after she talked about that.
Okay. And then how did it go getting an agent? How'd you start?
I was totally ignorant. I just sent it out with like a little letter. Boom. Hey, here you go. But then what I did is I spent $100 to take an online workshop about how to write that letter. And it was a really good $100 buy, because it came with two agents. You watch this. They kind of, I don't think you can really talk to them, but they kind of present something for an hour. But for your $100, they will read your query letter and your first page.
Oh, wow. Cool. And give feedback.
Yes. And so I I'd also been then reading kind of the structure of a query letter. Mm-hmm. And then they made a really good comment about my first page that I needed to switch the order of these a couple of paragraphs and have something more personal right up front under the first line. Hmm. And so I did that. And then I fixed the letter and I started getting requests for the manuscript pretty quickly after that. But oh, wow. I was about to give up on it because people, you don't get any feedback from agents. I mean, I didn't know all these things. So I thought, okay, it sucks. You know, everybody was wrong. It really sucks.
So but, how many, before you paid that $100, how many agents had you queried?
maybe 20.
Okay.
15, and I wasn't really hearing anything.
Okay. And you just said, okay, it sucks. I'm not going to keep working on it. Or
oh, then I went to the workshop, the $100 workshop.
So then after that, you started querying and you got more responses. So what kind of responses did you get?
It's all over the map. Send us 5 pages, send us 50 pages, send us whatever. And then I would either not hear back or hear back that it wasn't for them. That's when I started thinking, this sucks. You know, maybe
mm-hmm. I should. Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm. Then I think I got on Query Tracker. I had my whole spreadsheet, but I was getting pretty discouraged. One really like famous agent had written me back, had her assistant write to me, like they were very interested, but they wanted me to make it more traditional, like a traditional story. Mm-hmm. I wasn't going to do that. So
why?
I couldn't imagine it that way. You know, mm-hmm. it doesn't feel like that's how it, I'd have to cut out everything. I just have to tell it in a completely different voice. I can't even imagine that.
I'm so glad you didn't, because I really like your voice. But anyways, so you couldn't imagine in a different way, but was that hard to decide not to go that route? I mean,
it was hard because it felt like, oh, it's so close. They were really mm-hmm. interested. Mm-hmm. This is a really good agent. I thought about it. I went back and reread it several times trying to think how I could do that. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't see a way. And so I just moved on. Mm-hmm. Then in the middle of all this, somebody told me, yeah, you should also still send it out to small presses or contests. It was just a long process. So I did get this one small press in London, in England, was very interested. And I was interested in them. But then right before I signed the contract, thank goodness the editor said something along the lines of, I just don't know how I'm going to sell it. I'm like, what do you mean? She says, well, I can't get it into bookstores in the U.S. because of customs, and it's hard for us to get books here. I just go to book fairs. So then I talked. Then again, my friends here kind of got gathered around me and got me some advice about just drop it. Now, that was also really hard. I had the contract in my hand.
Yeah.
They were like, if this person's interested, you're going to get other people. Don't worry. Mm. And while I was querying and waiting, I did think about, you know, what if I tried to like publish an excerpt of it? I wonder mm-hmm. if that would help. Mm-hmm. So I took a bunch of time to create an excerpt. You know, I was even Googling, how do you create an excerpt? So I then created an excerpt, sent it to multiple places, and then also entered it into Bellevue Literary Review's nonfiction contest and won honorable mention. Mm-hmm. And that was really wonderful. Now, I think I didn't know for a year, though. So I entered it in that, was getting rejection from other places, but a lot of like, hey, send us more. We really like your writing. And then I did read that. I was just about to give up because I think I had reached out to like 70 agents, but I knew a lot of them weren't even reading it. You know, it wasn't going anywhere. So I read this one piece of advice on Query Tracker that said, if you're going, you know, a brand new agent's really going to want a sure thing. Mm-hmm. A really senior agent, they don't even need you. So you might try to find somebody who's been in it like 5 or 10 years. Hmm. So that's what I started to look for.
Okay.
And I just picked, like, I would go in batches of like 20 agents and I'd send out, whoops. I was looking for agents who'd been 5 to 10 years, sent out a bunch. And in that list, I'd included Claire Anderson Wheeler, who's since left agenting, sadly. But I just, on a whim, included her. I'm glad I didn't see this other description where she wasn't really looking at memoir. But the thing I had seen about her was kind of open to everything. So I heard from her within that week asking for, I think, 50 pages. So I sent it to her, but I'd been down this road before, you know.
Okay. So
I just didn't, you know, I didn't think much. I think somebody else at the same time in that group asked for 10 pages. And then I went off to my writer's workshop and, you know, put it out of my mind. And I'm sitting in the auditorium where we listen to other people read stuff. And I'm sitting right next to Abigail, who'd been, you know, giving me pep talks all along the way. Oh. And I see that I get up to go to the restroom and I see on my phone an email from Claire. And I'm like, oh gosh, I don't, this could be really bad. So I'm looking at my phone and she's like, I'd like to represent you. And I was like, oh my God. So yeah, I'm so glad I was sitting right next to Abigail when that happened. That was wonderful. It was a wonderful moment.
She celebrated with you. She was excited.
Oh yeah. And we had to be quiet. We were sitting in a room full of this auditorium and we were like, yeah.
That's funny. So then what did you do?
So then she and I had an hour long conversation on the phone. And then I got back to Raleigh. It was a wonderful edit that she wanted to know if I'd be interested in making. A key reveal, you know, Claire wanted me to move a section so that something else would be revealed much later on in the story.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I was all for it because I felt like it added a lot of power and she liked how it is the way that our culture kind of minimizes a certain kind of trauma.
Hmm.
And misunderstands, you know, and misunderstands and it mostly, I think. So yeah. I really liked that idea. The trick was how to uncouple some of the wordplay and some of the ways things were leaning on each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that was hard. So she's like, take your time. I know writers have other things going on in their lives. I work full time. So when I got back to Raleigh, I needed to move out of the condo I was renting and find a place to live. All that ended up in the story. And that took a while. Plus, then I was renovating the little townhouse I bought, living in a friend's guest room, working full time and working on the weekends to make extra money for my move.
Oh my gosh.
And I was trying to make these edits on the bed in the guest room. I did it. And then I moved in to my place and we were ready to send it out. And then COVID hit.
Oh, wow. Okay. Okay.
And that was so bad on so many levels. First of all, she was like, we're just not going to send it out for a while. And then I was in this neighborhood. I didn't know anybody. I mean, it was a really horrible time for me. It just felt like, so I'm deep in my story anyway, because I'm writing it and editing it, and just reminded me of being left in that apartment by myself.
Yeah, and you're all by yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. I was all by myself. I don't know anybody.
So isolated.
I can't even see any, talk to anybody. So I would just go into my office every day and pretend there were people there. But so that took a while before Claire felt like, okay, now let's start sending it out.
Okay. And how did all of the more present time, like the deciding to move, and how did that make its way into the memoir? Because it wasn't, you know, that was after you got representation for the manuscript. So how did you decide to make those changes?
Yeah. So the one place that Claire felt really needed some more work was the last section. So the last section we were working with a little bit, she was saying, you know, you really need to tie in like what the trip to New Orleans means and meant to your kind of awareness and recovery. You know, why are you there? Why did you mm-hmm. go to New Orleans?
Mm-hmm.
And also she was missing the young voice, like the mm-hmm. the ways that I make things alive. And I was like, oh, I still do that. You want to hear that? I do that all the time. I talk.
Interesting. That, okay.
I did some of that. And yeah, so then she felt like, okay, it's ready to go out.
Okay. But then COVID hit and you were incredibly isolated and also processing all of this past, all these past experiences. And so when did she decide that it was time to go out? How did she decide that? And how did you feel about it?
She was in touch with editors that she knew that for a while weren't working and now they were working.
Okay.
And that was the key. And I can't remember when that was, but it you know, we waited a little bit and then, we got these lovely effusive rejection letters from the big five, the top five, whatever you call them. And I couldn't believe it. They were, as Abigail said, I've gotten less expressive acceptance letters than you're getting. Rejections. And, you know, thank goodness for her because she knows the business. So she just kept reminding me that it is a business and people are looking at how much money they can make. They're not looking at necessarily at the quality of the writing all the time. Mm-hmm. It was still kind of, I was okay with that. I thought, let's go on to the next thing then. Mm-hmm. So Claire had a list of independent presses she wanted to send it to. And right around that time, I got the notice from Bellevue that I won their honorary mention, which is their second prize.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
That felt great. That felt fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was a help to her with her letters, I know, for Claire.
Ah, okay. Okay.
And they were also nominating it for the Pushcart, which they nominated me over the first place winner.
Wow.
So, okay. Is their sole entry for nonfiction. So, I was bowled over. It's this real roller coaster of like, oh, this sucks. Oh, my God, it's good. No, wait a minute. It sucks.
That's a really good way to put it. And so then...
So she had a couple different tiers of really top-notch indie presses. And we heard back from Grey Wolf.
Ooh.
They were interested. Yeah. They were interested. They wanted some... They weren't sure, though. And so they wanted some changes, but they didn't say exactly what. Mm. So Claire and I mean, Claire, she should get such a medal for all this. I mean, most people would have just given up. We went over kind of each section and she had suggestions about maybe take this out. So I did trim a lot. I was really worried about word count. And she goes, don't worry about that. Mm. So I trimmed things down to make it less, I mean, to make some of the extra things that really didn't get in the way, but some wordplay. Like, for example, when I talk about my mother being a dancer and then I have the definition of dance, I also had in there all the words that rhyme with dance in the rhyming dictionary, which was just fun because I had a rhyming dictionary when I was a kid. And, you know, it felt like it fit, but I was like, okay, let's cut that. Let's cut anything that seems a little extra. And we resubmitted it, and they were very, again, she told me that they send their very best to me. They think I'm a fantastic writer, but it's not for them.
Hmm.
I don't really know why. And she said, yeah, you're not going to know why. So I think there was another tier that rejected. And then, you know, I was about to give up, and Abigail said, you know, what about university presses? She goes, they are the new independent presses, and there's a lot of them that are doing fantastic work. So then, you know, that meant, I mean, days of researching which ones are doing this fantastic work, which ones will take nonfiction memoir, which ones really go with Southern writers.
Mm-hmm.
So Claire was like, if you send me all the information I need, then I'll send out the letter. We sent out a round and she heard back from University of Mississippi Press. They sent her a contract. Usually they will get in touch with the agent first and then, you know, the contract will come later. They sent her a contract. And then we waited 3 months for them to get back to her because she was wanting some to talk to them about the contract. Mm-hmm. You don't usually just sign it. There's usually a conversation.
Right.
She sent several emails to them and they didn't respond.
Hmm.
So they'd already sent it to peer reviewers who said these amazing things about it. So we had two peer reviews that they sent to us. Here are the two peer reviews. Here's the contract. I was ecstatic because Mississippi, you know, it's so close to Louisiana. It's just like a cousin. You know, I felt like they could do a good job with this story. While I was waiting, it was then Georgianne mentioned to me, University of North Carolina Press had a new imprint called Great Circle Books and that they might be interested. And I didn't think they would because I had already looked and they didn't, you know, take nonfiction, this kind of nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
But so I just said, all right, even though I had my heart sold on Mississippi at the same time. So UNC Press, we sent it to them. They're immediately interested. And at first I was like, oh, Mississippi. But UNC, they were so responsive and so helpful and really talking to me. And then right at that time when they're sending the contract, Claire's looking it over, I get a notice. I'd forgotten that I had entered the AWP contest. I mean, it's this national contest. And then if you win it, there's two categories and I think they might rotate. Maybe it's three categories and they rotate, I think, which year they're going to take nonfiction. But it's a judged contest. They have different judges every year for each of the categories. And then if you win the contest, you have a contract with the University of Georgia Press.
Oh, I see.
So it's guaranteed publication. And a lot of writers have kind of gotten their start there.
Oh, and interesting.
So right when University of North Carolina Press is offering me this contract, I get this notice that I won. I was like, and I won it. University of Georgia Press would publish this. And I get a stipend of a couple thousand dollars right off the bat. I just didn't know what to do. And so I just imagine me, I'm in this office. It's not deep into COVID, but people are still working from home, I think, except for me. I'm in this big office building, just me by myself with these phone calls, like from AWP and from University of North Carolina Press. And then Claire stayed after work to talk to me about it because I was freaking out. Like, where's you?
Yeah.
And everybody was so gracious. UNC Press was like congratulating me, but, you know, let's talk. Do you want to talk? Mm-hmm. So I set up a time to talk to them that night. And then Claire and I talked and she made some really good points. I mean, she was also congratulating me. She said, but find out if you get a chance to look at University of Georgia's contract. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a really big deal. And I found out immediately before, so we could have another conversation right then, that I would not get a chance to look at the contract.
Okay.
So she was like, you know, so she was pointing out the problems, but she was totally fine with whatever I wanted to do, but she wouldn't be able to help me if I did that. And then I think Georgianne set up a call for me that evening also with, or actually an email with this other writer, Robin Hemley, and who used to be a judge on that contest. And he was saying, Jesse, he goes, you have to make a decision about who's going to do better by your book, you know. Forget winning for a minute for that contest, even though it's very thrilling. Who's going to do better by your book? Who's going to promote it? Who's going to take care of it? And so then when I talked to this wonderful editor at UNC Press, Kate, she was, you know, reminding me of what they were going to do for my book. I'm the first book that Great Circle Books has put out. So that to me was the ticket, you know, and yeah. I was already in love with these people at UNC Press, Kate, and then Sonia, who's the head of publicity. They really have done such a good job helping me, supporting me. Probably, you know, I know so little about this. So I went with them, and I'm so glad. I don't have any regrets about it. Nothing against the AWP or University of Georgia. They're fantastic. But I had this incredible choice to make after such a drought. You know, that's what's so weird. So for me, what I would tell other people in this situation, like if you've got people that are really good writers encouraging you, that's just go with that and go with your gut. Mm. Forget all the rejections. And as hard as it is, you just keep plowing ahead. And one of the pep talks I would give myself is that my day job, if there's something I want to put in place, I just won't give up until I know it's good. I know it's for these families that I'm working for. Mm-hmm. I just will keep plugging away, even if it takes a year to get it, whatever it is, a grant, a film I'm trying to do, whatever it is. So I told myself, I have to think about myself that way. I have to think about my book that way. I doubted it so much through that experience of all those rejections, you know.
Yeah.
Will it really resonate with people? Will, you know, is the form so bizarre that people will struggle with it the way that agents were struggling with it, you know? So I was just stunned at the reception. And, you know, it was in the excerpt in The Guardian. There were like 2 million people who saw that.
Wow. And
so that was the first thing that happened, is this excerpt in The Guardian. And that was surreal. I mean, that was hard and amazing. And I was getting tweets from people sending love and compassion. So that was stunning. At the same time, it really shone a light for me on what I never got.
Mm-hmm.
That if I had had even one of those comments back when I was a kid, what a difference it would have made. That's what I was looking for, and I got none of it. So it was really painful.
Yeah, yeah. Painful to recognize how valuable it would have been to have that as a child.
Or to get these wonderful messages from complete strangers.
Mm.
It was wonderful, but I don't know them.
I see.
It was like rain in a desert or something. Mm. But still very, very meaningful to me to get those and to have that kind of confirmation that that's what should have happened. So that feels wonderful. The other thing is, at this age, I'm 65, and I feel like I was dealt this story early on. I spent my life kind of running away from it. I've now digested it, turned it into art, and put it back into the world. So that feels like a really healing circle for me, or a completion, like I don't have children. But when I look at my life as a whole, it feels like, well, this is something that I can do. I can contribute. I can release. And maybe, you know, if somebody feels less alone as the result of it, wow.
That's Stephanie Claire Smith and her book, Everywhere the Undrowned, A Memoir of Survival and Imagination, is available at the link in the show notes. I'm Brianna Avinia-Tapper. As always, if you liked this episode or previous episodes, you could rate us or review us wherever you get your podcasts. And I will be forever grateful to you for doing that.
Forget all the rejections. As hard as it is, you just keep plowing ahead.
Keep going!